Okay, you know, we got a packed session today because we have some stuff left over. We have some stuff left over from yesterday, so I'm going to actually get started. And, you know, for those of you who are wondering if I'm, you know, all talk and no action. Oh, come on. Oh, the battery's dead, right? Yeah, okay. So hold on. We'll get this figured out. Of course the battery's dead, right? Energy, we have an energy issue. Here we go.
Do you want me to try to get a battery?
No, it's fine. We can just, you know, we can handle it. So those of you who think, see, I really watched Tadoom, all talk, no action. Here's clean energy, hold the style. I was on the dish team today, so I just figured, you know, you want to know that I do something about clean energy other than talk about it. Okay. All right. And, you know, let me just say, scrubbing pans that had lentil loaf baked in them, left over, that took a lot of cleaning energy. So, okay. All right. So those, and I know there's some people here, this is their first time. Who has never heard of Holden Hilarity? Has anybody never heard of Holden Hilarity? Yeah. So, you know, Holden Hilarity is one of the values of Holden Village. And part of it is that, you know, one of our, basically the founder of Holden Village was a guy named Wes Preeb. And he had the driest sense of humor ever in the history of the world. And he used it all the time. And it's a tradition we try to use. So if any of you want to get silly, it's perfectly consistent with, you know, the Holden values. So, all right, a little Holden lore. So this session is going to be clean energy policy and politics, and this is a pretty amazing coincidence that we're dealing with this topic today. I don't know how many people have been able to dial into what's happening in Washington as we speak, but I'm going to give it to you hot off the presses. But today is probably one of the most significant days in terms of climate policy really ever, honestly. It's not as good as it could be, but it's a huge step. So there's a teaser. So one of the key concepts I keep talking about is think global, but act local, too. And like the COVID pandemic, in a time when we are all truly connected, the climate crisis has taught us that certain issues do require an all-of-the-above strategy, meaning personal, local, community, state, federal, and obviously international. I want to talk a little bit about California in terms of policy stuff because in many ways, and this is not, I'm not trying to brag or anything, but California has been a key leader in sort of stepping forward around climate and clean energy policy that frankly other states have then followed. And unfortunately, as I mentioned the other day, we're moving back and we're going to need others to step forward, but that's a story unfortunately I'll have to talk about. Where this, you know, one of the pieces of this is that many of you may have heard of a company called Enron, an energy trading company. And Enron, besides gaming energy markets in many places, they did so in California such that in 2002, there was, you know, major blackouts, not having nothing to do with the technical issues, nothing to do with the availability of power, but in terms of how they used this a deregulated market model to basically create artificial shortages such that they could then provide resources such that they could then make lots of money. And some people went to jail on that. But anyway, it led to the bankruptcy of one of the largest utilities in the country, Pacific Gas and Electric. It's had another bankruptcy since then. Many of us want to put it out of business for good. But one of the results was that the governor at that time, Gray Davis, was blamed for these blackouts, and he was recalled. You may be aware that there was another recall recently in California because people were upset with how our current governor has handled the COVID crisis. He was successful at pushing back that recall, but Gray Davis did get recalled, and Arnold Schwarzenegger became California's governor, which, you know, for a state that had Ronald Reagan, an ex-actor, as a governor, it wasn't that surprising in some ways. But as it turned out, Arnold Schwarzenegger was, and we'll talk about this story, I mentioned it earlier, actually a pretty significant figure in, you know, being a leader in the clean energy and solar revolution, and continues to work in that regard. But another thing that happened in that time frame as a result of the deregulation was their authorization of something called community choice energy. And it's basically a model I'm going to talk about because it's a policy framework that really leads to greater democratization, greater basically public involvement and public oversight of how energy gets delivered. So what is community choice energy? Basically, it's a model for energy procurement. It was actually first developed in Massachusetts, but it's taken off in California, where communities, cities, counties, you know, political jurisdictions, local jurisdictions, come together, form what's called a legal entity called a joint powers authority, to pool or aggregate their electricity usage in their communities, and in order to purchase energy and or develop local projects to provide energy on behalf of residents, businesses, basically everybody in their geographical locale. It's essentially sets up competition between the incumbent, who might be, in most cases in California, is a investor-owned utility, and this new entity, because people do have the choice to either stay with their incumbent energy provider or join the CCA. The CCA procures the energy or develops projects to produce that energy, but the investor-owned utility still does the poles and wires, the transmission lines, the distribution lines, and so forth, and maintains the grid so that that power that's produced here gets delivered to the customer. So why CCA? Well, one of the reasons that people, you know, wanted to join CCAs is because of choice. They wanted to have the ability to choose who they got their power from. We tried deregulation, where you could get power from multiple sources, and it spectacularly failed, that we just talked about. And they also wanted to have more control, local control and accountability, on how their energy was being procured. It's also become, in California, a way, and it's been a key part of it, is a way to help communities accelerate their climate goals, to move towards that 100% emission-free power. And it also is a way of having the money stay in the community instead of going to shareholders of a utility. Because it's a public entity, whatever benefits accrue, it comes back into that local community, which then gets used to establish local energy resource programs. I talked yesterday about the fact that I've got, you know, about, it actually was about $1,250 in incentives from my local CCA, Sonoma Clean Power, to offset the cost of putting in an electric heat pump that they use as a storage device to manage their loads, right? So that's a program that, you know, they've put that, you know, they've taken their quote-unquote profits and put that into programs like that. And the result is that these CCAs, and I know you can't read this chart, I'm sorry, but trust me that what it says is that in 2010, the first CCA formed after the law passed in 2002, and we'll talk in the politics session, why did it take 8 years to get the first one started? I bet you can guess why, okay? But the first one started in Marin County. Okay, now you can make fun. Everybody knows about hot tub land. And then over the years, they grew to now there's 26 and growing. And from covering 1% of California, they now cover 41% of all customers in California. Okay, and they've been effective at unlocking basically market demand or customer desire for choice in procuring and using renewable energy. The vast majority of these CCAs procure more renewable energy than the investor-owned utilities they compete with. As a result, CCAs in 2019 purchased 204% of the renewable energy required by state law. from 2011 to 2019. So in other words, the state has a requirement for how much, you know, that we have in California, as many other states do, what's called an RPS, a renewable portfolio standard, that requires your utility to increase the proportion of renewable energy that they use. CCAs did twice as much as what the state required, which is why California is rapidly getting to its goals way faster than they would have if they just stayed with these utilities. I'm losing my notes here for a second, sorry. So there are now 182 cities in California, cities and counties that belong to CCAs, and next year one of the largest ones will come online, the entire county of San Diego, which actually had was served by San Diego Gas Electric, which is a subsidiary of Sempra, which is a very large utility across the country. Sempra saw which way the winds were blowing and basically a couple years ago said, we're out of here, CCA. So there's not going to be a choice. It's just going to be CCA in San Diego County. Okay. So from that 2002 period when the law was passed around CCAs and 2010 to when the first CCA got off the ground, there were several other policy or political developments that I believe have changed the course of history in dealing with the climate crisis. So we're going to talk local and then global. Local is that, as I mentioned earlier, Arnold Schwarzenegger led a process to get the California Solar Initiative in place. That legislation basically said, we're going to invest in California $3 billion to put solar on, you know, provide incentives to put solar on a million roofs. And we talked yesterday about that. There's Arnold taking credit for what he did, and he did. And
is that you in the front row?
Yeah, that's me with the dark glasses. Yeah, that's me. Yeah. I'm smiling. I'm very happy. Yeah. He didn't want to talk to me though. I didn't get his autograph or anything. You know. It's all about Arnold. Let me just say. But also very important during that period was the investment tax credit that we talked about that George Bush and the Democratic Congress pushed through, which provides. Essentially, it provided for about 10 years for any solar project put into place, 30% of the cost was covered by the federal government, right? So you had that 30% tax credit. It's now gone down to 24%, but in this reconciliation bill, hopefully, if it stays in there, it'll go back up to 30% and be permanent. So that'll be a good thing. And then, so local, federal, and now international, very important, that the Germans and the Spanish in particular, but also Italy and several other countries followed suit, during that middle of the 2000s period, established what are called feed-in tariff programs, FITs, another FIT, another acronym, where essentially they said, if you build a solar plant, we'll buy the power and pay you for it. It was just a buy-all, sell-all is what they called it, incentive. And so those three things, basically, California CSI, federal ITC, German and Spanish FITs, sent this strong demand signal to everybody, but the Chinese were the ones who listened, and they built huge numbers of solar plants in the mid-2000s, such that economy of scale was achieved in production. We're not talking about any fancy whiz-bang new technology. This is technology that was invented in the U.S., oh, by the way, by Westinghouse back in the 50s to power satellites, right? And by the way, the first satellite that had solar panels is still operating, and the panels are still working. It's really kind of cool. But anyway, that supply-demand dynamic took hold, and that, you know, as we talked about yesterday, prices of solar came down. When prices come down, demand creeps up. We get the million solar roofs, we get the solar revolution around the world. So policy matters. This is a picture of the, you know, how the prices went from 2008 down to 2014. in terms of, this is the cost of energy, not the cost of panels, relative cost of solar energy relative to that. Okay. And then here's my little fun picture. Germany flag, Spanish flag, buy all, sell all. And so acronyms, CSI, what is that? Okay, plus ITC, plus FIT, feed-in tariff, equal Chinese solar manufacturing boom. There you go. So look at where, you know, solar panels were being produced up until, you know, as I said, 2005, 2006, ITC, CSI, FIT programs. I started my first company just around here after the ITC passed. You know, solar panel production was, you know, distributed amongst China, Taiwan, Japan, Malaysia, Germany, South Korea, and actually the United States, this teeny little one down here. And look what's happened, right? Right. So that game is over. Somebody came out of it. Can we get the solar industry back in the U.S.? Probably not. It's like saying, can somebody come in and replace Google? Going to be, or Apple. Pretty difficult. The Chinese pretty much have the monopoly at this point. If you got some ideas about how to do that, I'd be really open to them. But I think that game is over. So what about battery storage? Right? China currently dominates nearly every aspect of the lithium-ion battery supply chain, enjoying the ensuing economic and strategic advantages that come with it. China now controls 80% of the minerals used in EV batteries and also batteries associated with, you know, the energy system, accomplishing this dominance through purchasing mines around the globe, expanding mainland mining efforts, and dominating mineral processing. They can sell to the companies and countries they align with, and centralized control allows the Chinese Communist Party to ensure that Chinese battery cell manufacturers receive better prices and sometimes even exclusive mineral supply. The bill, the budget reconciliation bill, at least the version that we had before Joe Manchin changed things today, another teaser as to what's going to happen today, had a, you know, a good chunk of money to invest in a domestic, you know, battery supply chain. I don't know where that's going to end up, but my guess is it's going to be a heck of a lot less than what we thought it was going to be. But we'll have to come back. So, you know, the Chinese are likely to continue to go down this path and dominate. Now, again, you think, well, wait a minute. We've got the Gigafactory in Reno, and we got in Texas, a Gigafactory that's going to be opening soon. You know, Tesla making batteries, but they're making batteries with stuff that China has, right? The minerals, right? The processing of the various supplies. However, in California, Tesla and some others are putting big chunks of money into setting up a mining operation and processing operation in the Salton Sea. So we'll see how that goes. Okay, a few more sort of solar policy politics issues, and this is the setup for why you all should get involved in policy and politics, and some of the ways you might be able to do that. So a personal story. So that California Solar Initiative was set up to provide incentives that would go down over time because, you know, again, with scale, the whole idea of step downs and incentives is you as scale economies occur and the price of something goes down, the price of panels come down, you don't need as much incentive to make the solar projects economically viable, right? Makes sense. Except that the program was administered by, again, PG&E and the other investor-owned utilities, and they made a huge math error in how they calculated what those incentives should be, such that they ran out of money before the amount of gigawatts of solar was incentivized. They ran out about of that $3 billion. They spent it. Basically, $600 million was missing because they made a math error. So how do you feel about your utility making math errors? Okay. This is a little side note. So one of the things my company does is we go in, we evaluate the bills of a school or a water agency, and we come back and, you know, run analyses. Is solar going to actually save them money or not? Because I have to tell you, it depending on the time frame, most of the, you know, more often than not, the best we've ever had, let's in terms of the price curves, rates, and so forth, is 2 out of 3 projects make sense. We tell schools who aren't going to save money, unless you really want to do this for environmental reasons, don't do this project. Because our job is to, you know, make sure that good projects get built, because that's how we build support for this. But in the process of that, we look at people's bills. And about 1 out of 5 times, there's a mistake on the bill, on the bills. What direction do you think those mistakes are? Okay. So, you know, when they basically overspent $600 million, you know, we had a problem. So there was a Tracy keeps telling me not to say so. I thought you told me not to say so. Okay. Anyway, Senator from San Diego says, okay, let's do a bill and we'll make the utilities pony up on the money that they wasted. And the interesting part of that story, this was in 2011, and I had just been getting involved in some of the policy stuff in that year. My company, we had 3 people, what can I tell you? But we had a number of projects that had planned on getting these incentives, but they were gone, and the projects weren't going to go forward without the incentives. So I got involved in it, and on the very last, in 5 minutes before the end of the session, right, in August, end of the session, we needed to get at least 1 Republican vote, because California is mostly Democratic, but we needed 1 Republican vote to get the bill passed. This guy from San Diego, his name's Nathan Fletcher, had a question at 5 minutes to 5. Session ends at 5 o'clock, right? So we scramble around, and this is how politics works. We get the head of the assembly to stop the clock. Right. So the clock was stopped, basically, by law. So because the session has to end at 5 o'clock. But if you stop the clock, it's not 5 o'clock. We got him the answer to the question he wanted, voted for the bill, it went through. But absent that, $600 million of incentives, literally hundreds of projects would have died at that point. And I tell this story because, you know, politics, sometimes you think of it as this sort of obscure sort of power kind of thing. And there is a part of that. But part of it is goofy stuff. And you have to be prepared to get involved in goofy stuff if you're going to get involved in politics. The other part that I want to talk about in terms of California politics is under Gray Davis, under Arnold Schwarzenegger, for literally the previous 10 years before Jerry Brown came in as the governor in 2012, California had never passed a budget on time. They'd always, you know, budget's supposed to be passed June 30th. They never made that deadline. And so during the summer, there was all this horse trading back and forth, and workers had to get IOUs. It was a mess. And it also, as you can imagine, remember we talked about capital and the cost of capital? What do you think that did to the full faith and credit of the state of California, right? Which meant that the cost of borrowing in California was significantly higher than it should have been. And how do we pay for solar projects at public agencies? We gotta borrow money. The day that Jerry got the budget signed on time in 2012 was 3 days before I was closing a financing on a $5 million solar project. Bank of America, who was handling that, called me up and said, Rick, rates have come down 75 basis points. We're talking, in effect, hundreds of thousands of dollars of savings on this project for this school district, just because the budget got done on time. Now, of course, Bank of America said, and we're going to give you 50 of those basis points. And I said, no freaking way, you're giving me all 75, or I'm going to somebody else. And they gave me the 75. But the point being, there are these goofy kinds of things that happen that you have to, you know, intersect between policy and money and personality that, you know, what can I tell you? Let's see. There's one more story about California politics, and this is the sort of sad story and why we're going backwards. And this is a hard one for me. So one of the things that also incentivizes solar is what's called net metering policy. And it's a policy that says if you are producing solar at your home, your business, whatever, you're not always going to use what you produce, because there's going to be times of the day, particularly for schools in summer, they're cranking out all kinds of power they're not using because the school's shut down. As a result, and they get paid to deliver that power to customers, it makes sense, and they get paid the rate that the utility otherwise would have charged. Seems fair, right? But the utilities, you know, in their wisdom and in their effort to try to kill off distributed solar, lobbied, pressured, basically got a law passed that said, no, we're going to change that policy and reduce that benefit because it eats into the overall cost that we have for delivering power to all customers, even those who don't have solar, and we think it's unfair. Now, all the analyses have done, I showed you the analysis before, where California ratepayers are going to save $120 billion with distributed solar. It's, you know, dueling statistics. But for better or worse, they captured the California Public Utilities Commission. And part of how they've done that is they allied with what's known as the building trades, the group that represents electricians, plumbers, pipe fitters, so forth. How did they do that? Well, the largest number of employees in the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers is utilities, right? And so even though I am a true blue, as you probably have figured out, you know, labor Democrat, progressive, liberal, you know, flaming, whatever, labor is on the wrong side on this issue, and they are very powerful in California. And we haven't yet figured out how to deal with this issue, because they are single-mindedly and single-purposely trying to kill off distributed solar in California because of their concern that that's going to then lead to eventually these utilities. I mean, they also were totally against the CCA thing, right? Because eventually their employment would go away. Now, as it turns out, my projects, because my projects are commercial projects and public projects, they're governed by prevailing wage, which are laws that basically say you have to pay union rates for your, so, you know, my projects are fine, but they're still lumping this all together. It's a political dynamic that is problematic, and it's not just in California. It's going to be a problem, and we have to find a way to get beyond it, and I don't know what the answer is, to be honest. So talking about political dynamics, just a quick, you know, discussion question. What do you know? Oh, it's not there. Okay, I'll just tell you. What do you know about the political dynamics around clean energy and the climate emergency where you live? At the city level, the county level, the state, school district? Just, you know, what's your level of awareness of any of these kinds of issues in your local community or in your state? Pretty, yeah. And the reason I kind of expected that is, you know, this is stuff, as you could tell, pretty technical, right? And it's also fairly narrow in terms of who the stakeholders are. I'm doing this work, I'm delivering this message, because I think hopefully you come to understand that if you are interested in doing something about climate and about clean energy as a strategy around climate, you're going to have to learn more about how is your locality handling this? How is your state handling this? How do your representatives, what are their positions on net metering or on you know, renewable portfolio standard or on distributed generation or on competition with investor-owned utilities, all the issues we've been talking about. So one of the things I'm hoping some of you at least do is do a little bit of research on where that's at. And I actually did a little bit of research on some of your stuff that I'll show later on.
Hey, Rick, yeah. Does that show up like in the adoption of energy codes, or how does it?
Energy code is important. I mean, in California, one of the good things that happened this year is we passed a law that says that all new housing construction, any new housing, has to have solar and batteries. Now, if it's feasible. And one of the ways it won't be feasible is if the current Public Utilities Commission goes along with the utilities and their proposal to change the net metering rules that would reduce the value of exported solar by 80%, right? Because you can't say to a homeowner or a builder, you have to put solar and batteries in, but it's going to cost them more money than they're going to get back. So anyway, we're battling that one. So energy code is one place to look at, absolutely. And around things like, one of the things we also have done to basically move gas out is we've basically come up with formulas around a level of energy efficiency in homes, in new homes, that only heat pump water heaters and space heaters can meet. Gas can't meet it. They're not efficient enough. Now, so they didn't say you can't do gas, but they said you have to meet this threshold of energy efficiency so only electric can go in. And actually, I'll talk about this later, but some of you may have heard a year ago, the city of Berkeley, right on, passed a law that said no new buildings can have gas. All new construction has to be all electric. Gas is outlawed. And since then, 42 other communities have passed that law. No new gas. And I will be proud to say, as long as we're talking local, I mean, these are, and I'm seeding ideas here, because these are all things you could be doing in your communities. The city of Petaluma, where Tracy and I live, passed an ordinance last year that said no new gas stations. Now, we have too many gas stations already, so it wasn't a big deal. But they did put their foot forward and say, we're not going to have any new gas stations in Petaluma, again, to promote EV. So there are local, there's these little things like this that you can, you know, get people behind. But, you know, the opposition is strong. It's really strong. And one of the problems that we have in the political realm is, you know, the climate problem is so big and so bad, people kind of get into a gloom and doom kind of mindset. And I want to talk about that. If you go to doom and gloom, you're less likely to be disappointed if bad things happen, right? I mean, hope is courageous, right? Hope puts you out there, you know, to be disappointed. So doom and gloom is a little safer, right? But here's why it's not a good idea to go to doom and gloom. Four reasons. One, it plays into apocalyptic fatigue. People are navigating so much right now from the pandemic, killer bees, that their ability to put things in perspective is kind of limited right now. And when we're hyped up like this, we go into fight and flight mode, right? And we need to get people to slow down, understand the problem, feel some control based on a deep, because, right, knowledge is power, right? If we can understand the problem, not have it be this sort of out there thing, then they can start looking at what some of the options are for taking action. Second, doom and gloom saps people of agency, meaning that even if they're willing to grasp the extent of the problem, they won't feel they can do anything about it, so they won't. Third, it can lead to the what the hell effect. Once agency is gone, people may just throw in the towel and not only make it better, maybe make it worse. It's like the, you know, things are going to hell in a handbasket. Why don't I just, I can't think of what the things would be, but burn a lot of gas, do a lot of barbecuing, I don't know, whatever it is. Lastly, by reinforcing that everyone is not doing enough, it reinforces the social norm that to do nothing is okay. And we don't want to do that. We need to create the norm that doing something is what we all, you know, it's fun. We should be doing it, right? Like I said in that essay yesterday, I don't care if you recycle. You don't have to do everything, but you got to be doing the sort of core things based on the way we've defined the problem, which is holding your elected representatives accountable around what they're doing about fossil fuel, what they're doing about advancing the clean energy strategy. That's where the primary focus needs to be. And that's there's lots of ways to do that, which we will be talking about. So, action. I'm going to repeat Greta Thunberg's comment that I gave on the first day. The one thing we need more than hope is action. Once we start to act, hope is everywhere. This is from Alex Steffen again. I quoted him a couple times, and I want to read this somewhat long thing, but I think it really kind of encapsulates how to think about action, particularly in the political and policy sphere. We are deluded by the sad state of our political sphere into believing that action is uncertain. We might act, we might not. And even the way the coverage of this budget reconciliation bill this week has been all about the personalities, right? It's the celebrity game. Oh, are they going to do this? Are they going to do that? This is not true, untrue. Action is not a matter of whether, but when, particularly around these issues. I mean, you can't see the what the problem is and not realize. Something's going to happen one way or the other, right? So it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. In fact, the supposed uncertainty of action is a major predatory delay propaganda point. It's spin. It is continuity propaganda. The idea that, well, we just sort of keep, you know, doing things the way we've done them, things will be okay. So who makes what decision matters? We live right now with professional networks of expert decision makers who are deeply committed to making the same kinds of decisions they've been rewarded for making before. They are the owners, investors, managers, bankers, engineers, lawyers, psychologists, no, they're not in there, consultants, elected officials, bureaucrats, union bosses, advocacy leaders, philanthropists, journalists, and academics who are expert at building and running the systems that we have today. The decisions they've been making are the ones that have brought us to where we are. So who is in those positions makes a difference, and we need to put different people there, because the ones who are there right now are not making the right decisions, and they're making those decisions because it basically supports their current interests, you know, their jobs, their investments. All right, so again, reasons for hope. I showed you how quickly, since 2010, we went from 1% to 41% of California basically having an entity that is moving towards 100% clean energy in California. I mean, we will get there in 2025, 26 in California, okay? I just mentioned the code that said that all new, it's called Title 24, that all new housing construction must have solar and batteries if feasible. We're going to work on that one. We've got, you know, Chuck, Nancy, and Joe working on this bill today, which we'll talk about in a second. And this picture of indigenous people with their fists in the air, there's a study that just came out. It's unbelievable, but I looked into it. It's a valid study that indigenous resistance has staved off 25% of the U.S. and Canada's annual emissions. In other words, shutting down XL and all the other actions that indigenous groups have been doing to shut down coal plants has actually impacted 20% of U.S. and Canada emissions in the last 3 years. Think about that. That's political action reducing emissions. And you know, by the way, just as another shout out for Earth Justice, they're the lawyer who represented the folks, the indigenous, the Sioux tribe who fought XL. I talked about the methane gas shutdown that Berkeley has followed up. And the other one, and this is one that's, I'm a little, you know, as you can tell, I don't have a lot of fondness for Wall Street. But one of the things that's going on, actually, in the investment world, I've been, since I was 25 years old and got my first little investment for my retirement, been investing in, at that time, were known as socially responsible investments, right? It's gone through, then it was screened investments, and now it's called ESG, environmental, social, and governance investments. Basically, filtering your investments for companies that do non-harmful things, and particularly do things that are advancing the clean energy economy. Not investing in oil, not investing in gas, not investing in coal, etc. Which, by the way, as a financial strategy, has been very successful for me recently. Because the reality is, you know, as we've talked about, you know, the money guys in Wall Street are kind of getting it that oil and gas has seen its day. And so, you know, companies like Tesla and Sunrun and so forth, even GM, which, you know, made a commitment to 100% EVs. These companies are growing, and the companies that are not ESG companies are sort of laggarding. So one very simple thing you can do, and by the way, your Holden board has directed its investment committee to do this recently with our investments, is start looking at ways to move your money into ESG funds. And, you know, 5 years ago, there were a handful. Now, everyone has one. I mean, they're everywhere. So this is another thing you could do, and why I think there are reasons for hope. And then lastly, over the past year, the extreme politicization of climate discussions has started to shift. Pretty much everybody gets it because of the visceral experience. You know, there's no state that's it, you know, and particularly in the South with hurricanes and freezes and so forth, where there's been traditional resistance to understanding the climate problem as a fossil fuel problem. That's turning around. And one more reason is that the younger folks, right? Yeah. You know, the people in here, no. You know, the Generation Z, right? Our kids and grandkids, they totally get it, right? And unfortunately, a lot of them are in the doom and gloom thing about that. And we need to help them, actually, with that issue, as I talked about before. But, you know, you talk to kids who are coming out of business school, out of law school, out of, you know, computer and engineering and so forth, they want to get into clean tech. That's where they're you know, wanting to go. And as we've talked before, where's the job growth for folks who don't want to do the college thing? It's in clean energy. Electricians, plumbers, construction, you know, of windmills and solar plants and et cetera, et cetera. So that force is one that I think is going to become bigger and bigger, and hopefully, particularly in the upcoming elections, because... Oh, no, I have one more. We'll do the because in a second. So how to get involved. You know, when I send out what I'm going to do, you know, Rick asked to have me put together, a listing of some of the things, the writings. I'm going to do a bibliography, and I'm going to send it to Darius, and he's going to send it out to everybody who's on his list. If you're not on Darius's list, you should get on his list because he's a good guy. But if you're not on his list, you can give me your email address, and I'll send it to you also. But... These are the organizations that I'm involved in. Earth Justice, obviously, I've been mentioning a lot. Just to be honest, my best friend is the ex-president, so there is a little nepotism there. Sierra Club, you all know about that. League of Conservation Voters is very important in Washington in terms of federal policy. And then in California, we have something called the Solar Rights Alliance, which is a group of both residential and commercial folks who have solar, who are, it's more of a consumer-based advocacy group around policy. And then there's a national group called Solar United Neighbors. So if you're not in California, but you have solar and you want to get involved, Solar United Neighbors is who you should connect up with. And then I have this picture kind of indicate, you know, join these organizations, get involved with them, find the local organizations that are working in your community. I'm going to give a couple examples. Lobby. That's what the town hall thing is supposed to indicate. Run for office. Or find a candidate locally, right? I mean, the reason we had the ban on gas stations in Petaluma is because a young man who I had done some work with in the advocacy realm, it turned out he's worked for a clean energy consulting company, learned he lived in Petaluma. I and a number of people kind of nudged him along. He ran and he beat, to the surprise of everybody, you know, he beat a guy who'd been there for 15 years, and he advanced this idea. So it's, you know, it's not just you having to run, it's getting behind some people to make that happen. So we're getting to the end. So I promised a fourth and fifth D. Remember, decarbonization, distributed, democratization. Oh, wrong one. Oh, yeah. Before I get to that. So, hot off the presses. Okay? As we sit here today, I checked in. That's Joe Manchin, who just literally 2 hours ago, maybe it's three now, spoke to reporters and basically said he will support not the $3.5 billion reconciliation bill, he'll support a $1.5 trillion reconciliation bill. And Politico found the memo that he exchanged with Chuck Schumer laying out his spending, these are his spending conditions, okay? Sole ENR jurisdiction on any clean energy standard. Does anybody know what ENR stands for? That's the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Who's the chair of that committee? Joe Manchin. Instead of the Budget Committee, which normally, right, oversees this, who's the chair of the Budget Committee? Bernie Sanders, right? Spending on innovation, not elimination. Fuel neutral. What does that mean? Right?
Gas is still in.
Energy and vehicle tax policies. The carbon capture, and I don't know what US stands for, will be included. Ensure that carbon capture and coal and natural gas can feasibly qualify. Okay. If tax credits for solar and wind are included and extended, then fossil tax credits are not repealed. Okay? Including intangible drilling costs. Does anybody know about intangible drilling costs? We won't go into it. It's where basically oil producers get money from the federal government just because. And it's a subsidy that, you know, nobody else gets, but oil and gas producers get that. For enhanced oil recovery. Can you imagine what that actually means? Vehicle and fuel tax credits shall not be limited to electric vehicles. They must include hydrogen. That's not a terrible one, although, again, I don't think hydrogen is going to go anywhere anyway. But the point being, you know, he was the 50th vote. And what did he say this afternoon? This is the one I love because it really sets us up here. This is a direct quote. He said, if you don't like what I'm supporting, elect more liberals. Okay? Right? That's a clarion call. In 12 months, 13 months, we're going to have a midterm. If we want more than what we're going to get out of this bill, and again, we don't know what the details are. This was his little cheat sheet. We don't know how it, you know, the sausage making around legislation. There's going to be a lot of good stuff in there, believe me. It's not going to be what, you know, was hoped for. But we, you know, again, I don't get into doom and gloom. Every step forward, right? And this is a big step. $1.5 trillion is a lot of money. Now it's over 10 years. It's not like, right? It's nothing compared to what we have spent over the last 20 years on things that shall not be named. Yes?
Can you say in brief why hydroelectric doesn't show up here at all? I mean, in the Northwest, we've done a lot of hydroelectric.
Yeah, basically, hydroelectric is, this is a long story, but I'll try to give the short version. The key issue in hydro is not production of electricity because, in fact, most of the hydro that you're going to get has already been built, right? The key is what's called pump storage, where you take water and you pump it up from down below, and then you run it during times when other forms of renewables aren't available. And it's very expensive, but it's a way of creating a very, what's called, firm resource. So that's where the debates are around providing incentives for that. There's all kinds of environmental reasons why large hydro is problematic. Now, inline hydro, like what, I mean, we're doing small hydro here at at Holden. And there's something called inline hydro, where you just basically take, you know, pipes that go for irrigation districts, farmers, whatever, and you put these little hydro things inside and you generate electricity. That's something that does is going to get incentives here. But big hydro just doesn't have the growth opportunities that some of these other things do. And it's geographically constrained. Not like Washington isn't the most important state in the country, but there's not a lot of other places where you can, yeah. So that's where we stand. And you know, again, this was, we don't know what the finals are. All we know is that he made an agreement today such that the $1 trillion infrastructure bill, the roads and, you know, broadband and transmission line bill, voted out, you know, is either it has happened already or is going to come out of the House. The progressives presumably agreed to sign on, even though they didn't get everything they wanted. So the train is rolling forward. Happened today. Okay, let's go back to one piece of this. Sole ENR jurisdiction on any clean energy standard. So one of the key pieces in that budget reconciliation bill was actually a measure that was, I think, authored by, but at least the face of it, is Tina Smith. How many people here from Minnesota, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So Tina is your senator. We all know about Amy Klobuchar, right? Not many of us know about Tina. But Tina came forward with something called the Clean Energy Performance Plan, which was a very elegantly crafted piece of legislation that basically said, we will pay utilities a 4% per year premium for every electron that they increase in their renewable energy portfolio. So they're basically paying them to do even more renewables. Even though renewables are cheaper anyway, they're going to pay them for that because, as we all know, doing more renewables means they have less profit from the expense of transmission infrastructure. So this is compensating them for the loss of profit by doing that and penalizing those utilities 4% per year for not going that direction, going backwards. That's what he means by the clean energy standard. And what he's saying is my committee is going to govern how that program gets rolled out. And what we've heard is, again, through the grapevine, instead of 4% on either end, maybe 2 to 3% on the positive end, maybe 1% on the penalty end is what he's, and, oh, by the way, you know, coal is going to get a specific dispensation. Why? Why would coal get a specific dispensation from Joe Manchin? Why would that happen? Why would that happen? Can't imagine why. Let me just say, Joe Manchin has a blind trust that has about $5 million of shares in a coal company. And so he has no idea how this is going to affect his investments because it's a blind trust.
Hey, Rick.
Yeah.
When we were talking about, there was a fear that Joe Manchin would block Deb Haaland to become Secretary of the
right.
Interior.
Yeah. Right.
So.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. There, you know, pressure does, I mean, that when I talk about getting involved, you know, pressure matters. We did have in California a bill, 1124 this year, that would have done what that regulation we're fighting would have done, which is reduced the benefits of net metering by 80%. 30,000 people signed a petition. 5,000 phone calls went to every single one of the people in the California Assembly, and it was killed. And this was a bill that was carried by one of the most powerful members in that assembly. So people action can make a difference. That's why. But you have to be part of an organization. Like in this case, it was the Solar Rights Alliance that called people. And by the way, 40% of the people in the Solar Rights Alliance are registered Republicans. Okay, because again, money talks. You know. And choice. Their thing is choice. They don't want to be told by their utility that they can't do solar. All right. So here's the ENR committee. Let's see. Who's on that committee? Anybody here from Washington? Now, Maria Cantwell will receive your calls and be very, but give her a call about this issue, okay? Let's see, is there anybody here from, oh, Montana. Again, no, you know what? Let me just say, did I tell the story about Devin Nunez?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, okay. Devin Nunez saved the ITC in 2015. So don't give up, you know, particularly in a, no offense, small state like Montana, which has slightly more population than my county, and has two senators and two representatives, and I have, you know, anyway. I know. You have two senators, though, okay? So there's no reason not to give him a call. There's no reason not to visit him. I'm sure some of you know people who know him, right? Have the conversation, at least, right? Let him know, you know, how many people have ever done any kind of legislative lobbying kind of stuff? You know, these are human beings also, and they do respond in a human way. No matter what their political perspective or party identification, they are human. And, you know, they do want to hear what you have to say. They may ignore it, but they do want to hear it. And then let's see, do we have anybody here from North Dakota? Yeah. All right. I mean, again, this is going to be for real in the next 2 weeks. So, if you take nothing else away from this, give them a call. Ask them what their position is on the clean energy performance plan. Ask them what are they going to do about that? It'll make a difference, and you never know. I mean, you just never know. Maybe somebody will stop the clock, and you know, goofy things happen in politics. And so the fourth and fifth D's are determination, and of course, disruptive. Right? You got to be determined. And, you know, really be committed and be prepared to, you know, have things get shook up a little bit, make people, upset, because it's upsetting what the alternative is, right? It's not radical to be disruptive right now. It's about saving the planet for our kids and frankly, for ourselves in the next few years. Okay, so 4 minutes. Questions, yeah. Comments, reactions. Yeah.
Maybe you can cover this tomorrow, but in case I missed it, I never saw a graph or map, if you will, that said, you know, these, we know California's adopted this pretty significantly, but what about other states and states where, you know, it's dark half the year?
Yeah. Well, again, many of the states that are dark half the year have a lot of wind. Right? I mean, is anybody aware of how much, you know, Texas is the largest wind, you know, energy producing state in the country. And they do actually export some of that power to some of those other states that are dark. Wyoming is rapidly increasing its amount of wind. So it's not just about solar, I guess is my point. I am very California centric. That's where I've spent my life. That's what I know about. I can look and see, you know, where things are at between now, hopefully, and tomorrow, in terms of some of your other states. But I challenge you to do some of that research also.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But it's not just about solar. And frankly, you know, no offense, but if Montana doesn't get to 100% emission-free, that's not a good thing. But in the scale of the problem, we need Illinois and, you know, we need the Big Ten, right? New York, you know, we need the Big Ten, where, you know, in terms of the overall energy mix, yeah. And China, of course, and India, and, you know, but let's not get too crazy, yeah.
When you showed that map of China and all the different places where they're making batteries,
right,
and mining
stuff. Yeah.
So what worries me is that they are not probably being very environmentally responsible
no.
in doing all of this.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We, you know, and it keeps coming up. Yes, and again, as I mentioned to other people, my easy answer, which is not really an easy answer, but is there's trade-offs. I'd rather have the batteries, and I know that that's selfish, particularly for the people who live in those places. But let's compare that also against the environmental damage that the oil industry has done, all over the world. I mean, I have a close friend who's a chief of a tribe in Nigeria in the Delta region where, what they've done to his community and the communities in Southeast Nigeria is, criminal. And because he's an environmentalist, he spent half his life in jail and can hardly walk, all the beatings he's gotten. I mean, it doesn't excuse what's happening in lithium mining, but we got to see it in the broader context. Other comments or questions?
I was just going to say, China, I mean, they're experts at playing the long game.
Yep.
And, I mean, this is a country that, when COVID hit, put a 400-bed hospital together in 8 days.
Yeah.
They can change on a dime.
And, there are vulnerabilities there because, centralized control, what do we say about big systems? When they go down, they go down big. They can do lots of things. They can get things done. And frankly, as a fairly libertarian, liberal kind of guy, I'm very suspicious of centralized authority. In this case, we need to move quick, right? I was talking to somebody in World War II, when Roosevelt realized we didn't have enough tanks, what did he do? He said to the, CEOs of GM, Ford, and Chrysler, you're not making cars anymore. Right? You're making, tanks and trucks and Jeeps. We may get there. We may get to that point where we have to do that kind of stuff because of the consequences are so dire if we don't.
And there ain't no long game.
There ain't no long game there. Yeah. Yeah. It's right now. Any other comments or questions? All right. Tomorrow, we are going to mostly be doing dialogue and ideas exchange and maybe even some organizing around taking action. I'll be providing some ideas, some frameworks. Hopefully, political action, though, is something that you want to put on your list, as what you take home. But we'll be talking about other kinds of things and just sort of shooting the whatever. Yeah.
And maybe we can sit by our stage.
Yeah, that was one of the things I was thinking of. Yeah. That's right. I had one more thing I was going to tell you about, and I don't know where the slide went. This is the last thing. Where the heck is it? In the star... Oh, okay. I'm going to go late once. This is a picture of a gas-fired power plant in northern Minnesota that's currently in financing and under construction. The utility in northern Minnesota that had originally invested in this plant decided to sell off a big share of it to a utility in North Dakota because of pressure from a local environmental organization that says, we don't need this gas-fired plant. We have plenty of capacity if we grow community solar and other renewable resources, and we don't want to be saddled, Minnesota ratepayers don't want to be saddled with the cost of this plant. That was in the newspaper this morning. I meant to put a slide together around it. But anyway, get you the name of that organization because it's probably one you might be interested in supporting. It's Minnesotans for Lutefisk and Clean Energy or something. I don't know, right? Something like that. I'll get you the name. Yeah. Thank you.